Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Leading Edge Love Radio. This is your host, Sumati Sparks, the Open Relationship Coach at sumatisparks.com. And today I'm really excited to have as my guest Francesca Gentile. She's an international presenter and teacher, an expert on conscious non-monogamy, sacred eros, sacred kink, and the use of therapeutic tantra and therapeutic kink in healing from abuse. She's also an initiated shaman, a clinical sexologist, a relationship counselor, and the host of Sex, Tantra, and the Kama Sutra. She's an author and the director of a couple of sacred schools. I mean, I don't think this woman ever sleeps, so we'll get into some of her work as we get farther into the interview. So welcome to the show, Francesca.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
So glad to have you. So I'm really interested in learning about the therapeutic tantra and therapeutic kink that you use in your healing practice. And I don't know if we want to start there, but that's very fascinating to me. And I'm sure that you have, some personal story behind being able to do that kind of work. So would you mind if we just get right to it and talk about that?
That's a beautiful idea. Yeah, let's talk about, what is therapeutic tantra versus regular tantra? What is therapeutic kink versus regular kink? And why would we even want to do it? And I think that for me, let's just distinguish, because not everybody knows all those words that we've just thrown around like word salad there for a moment, is that tantra is originally a spiritual path whose goal was the loving and unconditional acceptance of all that is, which is really beautiful. And the head of the Buddhist tantric order is actually the Dalai Lama. So we get this sense of it's a spiritual path. But all of life was meant to be embraced in that. And because the West has so many wounds around sexuality, I feel that that's why tantra has come to focus on the sexual part of tantra, when in reality it would just be a very small part of this spiritual path. Not excluded,
right,
but not the sole focus either. And so in what we call tantra, we have spiritual practices, we have breathing practices, we have body practices, we can have mantras, which are phrases you repeat, or yantras, which are images that you look at, or asanas, which are body postures. And all of these ultimately are meant to have that sense of oneness. Now, for me, that's a perfect link to the therapeutic use of tantra, because if we think of therapy, that therapy in its root also means healing. It's a pathway to healing. How and healing has the same root as wholeness. So basically, how do we get to wholeness? How do we get to a place of peace in our hearts, presence in our bodies, joy in our lives? How do we get there? And when we have an intention to use the practices that are available in either a more ancient tantra or in a more modern tantra, if we have an intention to use those practices to move us toward wholeness, those practices become therapeutic. So we could take those practices and we could use them for sexy fun times. Let's breathe together so we could have sexy fun times. And, there's nothing wrong with sexy fun times. However, as one of my mentors taught me, and one of my mentors is Lori Grace Starr, and who was trained by Osho, who was a modern mystic, created his own version of tantra, very kind of the root of modern tantra in many ways. She started to, like many people believed who were children of the 60s, that if we had enough orgasms and if we had enough sex, that all of our issues would be healed. So she, started to use the tools of tantra to create that. Well, she was able to create that for herself and others, but she saw relationships falling apart. Like, it really did not help people sustain their relationship. And then
she saw that people had wounds and that they needed to go back into childhood and really heal trauma. And then she started to use the techniques of Tantra and other things that she knew as well to really support this rewriting and healing and rewiring the past. And that was also beautiful and had people feel more joy in their lives and more presence in their bodies, but their relationships still were falling apart. And then she added nonviolent communication because she recognized that we are not trained to speak to one another in ways that are collaborative, respectful, honoring. And then that really ended up being kind of the wonderful cake, you know, the recipe that really built to something gorgeous. Well, when I started to look at all of this, and I do work with all of it, one of the things that I started seeing over and over again is statistics that say that 40 to 50% of us were raised in families or environments with severe emotional, physical, sexual, and or spiritual abuse and trauma. Well, that's practically every other person. Given those statistics, I started to feel like it was a crime to not learn about how to utilize every skill set I could get my hands on to help with recovery from trauma, to help with a sense of return to wholeness. And then 96% of us are raised in families or environments that are dysfunctional to some degree. So if, like me, you were raised in a family that never taught you anything particularly healthy about boundaries, you know, that boundaries were, it's my way or the highway because I'm the parent. As long as you're under my roof, you have to, you know, live my way. If, you know, I'll tell you what to do, Missy, you know, it's this very hierarchical version of boundaries. Well, that's not healthy boundaries. And that doesn't teach the child how to honor their own boundaries. So when I looked at all of this, I'm like, oh my goodness, I am called. My calling is to help human beings and myself come into a greater sense of peace and wholeness. And so that's where I focus the skills of Tantra. And then the same thing would be true for BDSM. So BDSM, for those who may or may not know, is bondage, domination, sadomasochism. It's also dominance and submission. It's also discipline. It can also be a surrender. It can be master-slave. Those four letters can represent many things. And this world of BDSM has, you know, like Tantra has its own toolkit, so to speak, its own practices. The world of BDSM or kink has its own toolkit. It has its own practices where of sensation, of stingy or thuddy or restraint or reduction of sensation like blindfolding or earplugs or wrapping someone's body up very, very tightly like you would swaddle a child. And BDSM has role play, exactly. And so there's another set of tools over there in the world of BDSM. Now, once again, we could be using those tools, which some people call toys. You could be using them for sexy fun times, which is awesome. And yet, we could also be using those same tools to say, how can we contribute towards one another's wholeness? How can we recover, uncover, discover what is lost, missing, hidden, rejected, or denied in us? How can we really recover from our youth and childhood?
Right. Can you give us an example of how you would use a tool from BDSM for someone's healing from abuse?
Yes, I can. So one of the things that I had kind of a recovered memory recently, which is that my mother thought it was important for me to stop sucking my thumb. And this felt so important for her when I was, you know, maybe two. It felt so important for her that I stopped sucking my thumb that she would put iodine on my thumb, but I would still suck my thumb because I slept in the attic and I was lonely and I was frightened and I would cry myself to sleep. So I would still suck my thumb. And then she tried to put mittens on my hands to try to, you know, get me to stop sucking my thumb. And that didn't work. And so eventually she tied me to the bed. And I was only, you know, 2, 2 and a half. And she would put me to sleep at 7:30 at night and then get me at 7:30 in the morning. So basically, as a child, I was tied to the bed for 12 hours.
Wow.
I don't think she was trying to be abusive. I don't think it was in her mind to create trauma for me. I think that in her mind, she was trying to avert what she felt the bigger problem was, which was thumb sucking. And, you know, people often don't question the way they were raised, so then they just perpetrate however they were raised to the next generation. And so when I recovered this memory, I realized, like, no wonder I've been afraid of ropes. Like, in it's kind of a fun thing in the BDSM world to tie people up. And I see people having so much fun with it. And then I'm like, no, don't tie me up. No, don't do it. And I had such an aversion to it. And I also had an experience where I was, a friend was making a body cast of my body to use as a statue. And when they were doing the body cast, I got nauseous and fainted. And once again, I didn't know why. And so this recovered memory, when I looked at this, I thought, wow, this, in this moment where this happened to me, I started to believe that the world was unsafe, that you couldn't tell the truth. I started to feel anxious in my body in a certain way. So how would I use BDSM to actually heal this? And I'm actually designing this right now with a friend of mine, is we're designing a scene where we would maybe just get the rope out and just have me hold the rope. Like, just mm-hmm. hold it and see what the feelings are holding it. Maybe drape the rope, just drape it on my wrist, not even tie it, and feel the feelings. Now, one of the things you're starting to get in this process of using therapeutic kink is the slowness. When we're talking mm-hmm. recovery from trauma, it is glacially slow. Things cannot be moving fast. And it is so important that the authority be returned to the person that it was taken away from. So my authority over my body was taken away when my mother tied me up. Most of us, our authority over our bodies as children is taken away by our parents and by society. We are powerless as children. We're trapped. We are often perpetrated against in so many ways, from the subtle to the big and overt. Subtle meaning, you know, finish all your food, or you have to hug Aunt Sally, or you're not, you don't hate that person. Being told what we think or believe, being told who we mm-hmm. should touch or the touch we should receive, being told how much to eat or when to go to sleep, all of that trains us away from our own inner authority. And so mm-hmm. when we're looking at utilizing kink, it's really supporting, if in my case it would be me, to have choice at every moment. Even more, you know, we say in the world of BDSM that consent is important, and it is. But I can tell you that if you talk to people in that community, that even though consent is important and even though we negotiate right and left, we get excited, we get carried away, and many times even the nicest people will end up crossing a consent boundary because, I thought you meant that you wanted me to keep going. Mm-hmm. I thought that because you were making yummy noises that you actually wanted me to go further than we had negotiated. And, you know, that kind of issue still shows up in the world of kink.
Yeah.
But if you're literally talking about therapeutic kink, the person receiving has to be in complete control of the pacing every moment.
Right, and I was just thinking that even non-kinky people can learn a lot from the tools that kinky people need to use with regard to boundaries, communication, safe words. They have to be really good at it when they're playing with the edge. And those are skills that even non-kinky people can learn from and use to some degree. Similarly, I think that monogamous people can learn a lot from non-monogamous people, because I always say that monogamous people can push things under the rug for years or even decades, but non-monogamous people kind of are forced to talk about things and are forced to talk about what they want and need and ask for what they want if they're going to have successful non-monogamous relationships. So why don't we segue into talking about non-monogamy? I appreciate how you bring the sacred into most everything you do. And so maybe you could define for us, what is sacred non-monogamy?
Well, first I want to out myself by saying that I don't believe that there is one true right and only way to design or format relationships. I don't think non-monogamy is right or better than monogamy. I don't think polyamory is better than open relationships. I don't think swinging is better, or, you know, monogamy is better, or BDSM is better, or something else is better. I think that there are skill sets that when we practice those skill sets, when we practice those techniques, that they bring greater ease, greater harmony, greater growth into any design or format of relationship. And I personally call myself omniamorous. And what that means to me is that I can be happy in monogamy, or I can be happy in non-monogamy. It really depends on the people, or I can be miserable in either of them too. It really depends on the people, right, including me. And you know, what are some of those skill sets? So, and I would say that some of those skill sets are part of what make it sacred. So if another way of saying sacred is conscious, is caring, is considerate, is connected to something beyond ourselves, connected to a sense of the great harmony rather than what's just in it for me. You know, what is the highest and best harmony for all concerned is, to me, a form of making something sacred. And when I look at those skill sets, to me, or practices, one of them is honesty. So regardless of the design or format, if I'm withholding information about, even from myself, if I'm withholding that I really don't like something, even from myself, if I'm withholding that I have a boundary here, if I'm withholding some piece of crucial information, that is going to hurt our relationship, whether we're doing a kinky relationship, a monogamous relationship, an open relationship, or something else. It's going to hurt us. So a transparency, but also a self-awareness. I feel like one of the practices that's so important in relationship is, am I willing to keep digging in to who I think I am and discovering more about who I don't even know myself to be yet? Am I willing to, instead of just reacting, say, why am I reacting? I mean, not because of what you said or didn't say, Sumati, but because of, wow, the intensity of my reaction, always from the past. So this is a mantra. The intensity of the reaction is always from the past. There might be something, a boundary to express, a request to make in the present. But if I'm in my centered adult self, I just express the boundary. I just make the request. And if, for whatever reason, you and I can't collaborate in a healthy way, I will complete the relationship. But when I'm in my child self, when I'm in my younger self, everything is life or death. How dare you, Sumati? How could you? Why are you even treating me like this? You know, everything becomes this big drama, and I'm obsessed with you, and I can't believe you treated me this way, and you're abandoning me, and you're rejecting me, and it's like everything's being done to me. And and that kind of intensity, I now follow and say, aha, some wounding in your past. This is actually not about your relationship with Sumati. This is actually about some wound in your past. So let's separate these things out. Let's heal from the past. And there may be a request to make. I'm pretending that you and I have a relationship. You know, so that skill of that self-awareness, understanding what is a wound from the past versus being able to make an adult request or boundary in the present, being transparent, being able to reveal things when they're
difficult, or I'm afraid you might not like me, or I might lose connection with you, and yet a willingness to reveal it regardless, a willingness to ask the tough questions. You and I are both coaches and counselors, and I'm sure you recognize when I say this is that many of the people I coach around dating are very afraid to ask the tough questions or to reveal themselves because their need, their neediness to be loved, their need to be loved, their need to have a relationship, their need to be approved through sex or love is bigger than their centered ability to create healthy relationships. And let me just raise my hand and say I've been there. I've been there. I'm not saying, oh, these other people who do these things that I've never done. Let me just say I've done them. And just when I think that I'm, you know, really getting good at relationships, something will happen like the death of my mother, and I'll regress. Like, she died about 8 years ago, and I really found myself fragile and regressed and needy on a level that I hadn't been in years. So, you know, even when you know, we make progress and we can be proud of ourselves, doesn't mean that, you know, something in life can't, you know, hit us kind of off center, and then we're having to, you know, heal all over again and, you know, practice the skill sets we thought we learned all over again. You know, that can also happen.
Right. So I've known people who chose the path of open relationship even though they didn't feel like they were, you know, really a non-monogamous person, but they chose it because they wanted to use it as a healing path. They wanted to use open relationship as a way to kind of intentionally trigger some of their wounds so that they would have an opportunity to heal them. Do you see using open relationships in that way, or how do you use open relationship to heal?
Yes, I would say, what I would say, Sumati, is that all of life is an opportunity to either replicate our woundings or to heal from our woundings. Like our relationship at work, our relationship with our kids, if we've got them, our relationship with our friends, our clients, our students, you know, it's all an opportunity to replicate woundings or to heal. And same relationship. So if I go into relationships and say, I'm going to take on relationships as a spiritual path, as a healing path, that to me is one of the best ways to be in relationship. And once again, regardless of the design or format, because sooner or later in relating, my stuff is going to come up. My fear of being trapped, my fear of being abandoned, my fear of not being heard, my fear of being hurt, not being seen, not being valued, you know, whatever those fears are that we humans have, they're going to come up sooner or later. And knowing that, and knowing that, saying I'm taking this on with you as an opportunity, sooner rather than later, let's agree to get counseling or go to workshops. Sooner rather than later, let's hold this in a very tender way that our bigger issues are coming up. I remember one of my partners, we were exploring dating a friend of ours and going slowly, because that's something that I like to do, and it's preference is to go slowly. That, to me, that's part of the healing, once again, is it's easier to engage in a healing kink session. It's easier to engage in a healing tantric moment. It's easier to engage in healing relationships if we're going slowly, because then we can breathe into those moments. We can really notice what's coming up. If we're going fast, it can be fun, but it can also be a recipe, a high-risk recipe for emotional damage. And so we were going very slowly, and we had had a couple dinners, and then we'd taken her to a birthday party, and we were holding hands and walking down the street, and we were all sitting on the couch cuddling, and then at the end of the night, there was a kiss goodbye, just a little kiss goodbye. And I had requested that he talk to me before he kissed her. But in the moment when the kiss happened, and it was a little kiss, you know, I decided, well, you know, it's not that big of a deal. It was a little kiss. But he turned to me, and he was like, oh, my God, I didn't tell you. Oh, my God, you know, you're going to be upset with me, and it's going to be terrible, and it's not going to be okay anymore. And he just started to spin. And I'm like, honey, mm-hmm. honey, sweetie, I'm not that upset. Honey, hello, honey, I'm not that upset. And for the next 10 hours, like until the next morning, he would wake up every couple of hours. I know you're so upset with me. I know it's not going to work. I know that you're not here with me. And I'm like, honey, sweetheart, can you see me? Sweetie, can you see me? Do you know that I'm here? Can you hear what I'm saying? And eventually around 11 o'clock the next day, he said, oh my God, Francesca, self was missing for like 12 hours. I said, yes, it was, honey. Wow. I think we've reached the core wound area. And I want you to know that this is bigger than I, as your partner, can handle. Like, I can help you with mm-hmm. some of this, but really mm-hmm. this is your core wound. So my request is that you go into therapy, because this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity, sweetheart, to heal something of a trauma from your childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And at first he was going to do it, and he was going to set up therapy, and he was going to look at this. But, you know, we often have a resistance to our own healing. So as he got closer to when he was supposed to have the appointment, he ended up feeling, he had one appointment with the therapist and then said, oh, no, that's an unhealthy therapist and I can't possibly be with them. And I said, okay, then find another. And then he just stopped. And I really don't think the therapist was that unhealthy. I actually think it was his own wounds that were coming up. But that was an opportunity. That was such a gorgeous opportunity that could have been gathered and could have actually transformed both of our lives. But, you know, that's why I think there's this an opportunity when we're going slowly. If we'd gone quickly, let's say we just jumped into bed with her, and now, you know, we're having this big, you know, amazing, hot and passionate threesome, I believe that wound would have shown up, maybe even bigger. And then maybe it would also, her wounds would have shown up and my wounds would have shown up, because now all three of us are stirred. But because we're actually going slowly, it also gave me the opportunity to be very centered and be like, hey, honey, not my stuff, sweetie. I'm
yeah,
fine.
I was
going to
say,
be
that's
fine.
Amazing that... Yeah, it was amazing that you were able to be so loving and compassionate about it and hold the space like that, because oftentimes you could have gotten triggered by him being in that place for so long and just kind of gone, okay, enough already. But you were so patient and you stayed with him until he got to the other side. And you're saying that you were able to do that because you were going slowly?
Actually, for me, that really helped, because I was staying in my center. And I would say for me, this may not be true for everybody, but I feel that I can use various things to avoid my feelings. So I can use food to avoid my feelings, or I can use shopping to avoid my feelings, or I can use, you know, falling in love or lust with someone to avoid my more uncomfortable feelings. So part of staying sober for me is going slowly and not letting myself get high and not letting myself go into this, oh my God, you're the best thing since sliced bread and our sex is the most amazing we've ever had. Because, you know, my own experience is if a high happens, then a crash is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I would rather not have the crash.
So, in case you're just joining us, you're listening to Leading Edge Love Radio. This is your host, Sumati Sparks, the Open Relationship Coach at sumatisparks.com. And we're speaking with Francesca Gentile about all things conscious non-monogamy, sacred eros, sacred kink. And right now, you mentioned something about the high that we sometimes get when we fall in lust with somebody. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about how you've been able to tamper that a little bit when you've met someone new, so that you're not in that state of new relationship energy, that high that comes, and it feels really good, but there's usually, like you said, an accompanying crash that comes afterwards. So how were you able to learn to kind of slow that down and not go for that drug, and kind of distinguish between your sexual vibrancy versus the sexual compulsivity?
That's such a great question. Well, how this happened for me is that I would often, meet someone and sparks would fly and there would be that chemistry and I would feel such a deep connection. And I would feel like I just had to follow it and I was meant to follow it. And, you know, we see a lot of that in movies and TV and music. And, you know, I felt like I was just being normal. But what would happen is that in a way that I was originally unconscious of, when I would fall in love and lust, which is my personal heroine, the combination of love and lust, when I would fall in love and lust, I would want to have more of them, more of them, more of them, more of them. I'd want to, you know, see them every day. I'd want to have sex with them all night over and over and over again. And I would almost just kind of binge on them. And, you know, that high, which is something that is a chemical high in our own bodies, that high of phenylethylalamine, oxytocin, serotonin, adrenaline, dopamine, that high will eventually drop. And because I didn't know that this was just neurobiology, what would happen is when the drop would start to happen, I would say, once again, I'm going to pretend that you and I are in a relationship, Sumati. I would say, you know, Sumati, you don't touch me the way you used to. You don't look at me the way you used to. I mean, you used to just drive me crazy in bed, but now you don't. And you're the problem. So I would think that you were the problem. And because I thought that you were the problem, I would justify, when I was in a more monogamous paradigm, I would justify going out and having an affair. I would justify going out and getting something going behind your back. But I found that in polyamory, because you can cheat in polyamory because polyamory has agreements, I would find that I would even cheat in polyamory because I would want to break agreements that I had made with my one or two partners in order to get that next tie with that next person. Mm-hmm. Well, while this was happening, somehow I would normally be drawn to other sex and love addicts who would want to be in this high with me. Well, somehow I met a really healthy guy. So in the process of really trying to absorb him, you know, just do more and more, I want to see you more and more, I want to have more and more sex with you, I want to be with you more and more, you know, be my fix, be my drug, keep me high. He said, Francesca, there's something unhealthy about this, and I'm going to break up with you now to give us a chance later. And wow. He walked out the door, and Sumati, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I was shaking. And I had already been through recovery for compulsive overeating. And I knew what it was to be in withdrawals. And I knew what it was to be in recovery. And I went, and I said to myself, Francesca, you are not grieving the breakup with this guy. You're in withdrawals. Like, let me just tell you that the shaking, the inability to eat, the inability to sleep, those are withdrawals, girlfriend. And I, like, picked myself up by the scruff of the neck, and I walked myself over to Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. And just in case people are frightened, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous doesn't mean you're not going to have sex and you're not going to have love. Like food, you can't stop eating food, right? If you stopped eating food, you'd die. You know, when you're in recovery with food, it means that you have a right relationship with food. I eat beautifully, but I'm no longer using food as my drug of choice. So as I've gone into recovery with sex and love addiction, I still have sexuality. I still have a delicious life. It's just I'm no longer compulsive about it. And so I had to, you know, first step, you know, kind of like the first step is you have to face, wow, I am out of control. This is compulsive. I am lying. I am breaking agreements. I have to have this so bad that I'm willing to hurt people that are important to me just to get that high, just to get that connection, just to have that like moment without a condom, even though I have a condom agreement, just to have that moment, that extra moment of my fix, even though I have an agreement with my other partners that I'm only going to see my new partner once a month. And now I'm sneaking around to try to just get a little bit more high, just a little bit more juice. And, you know, we have to face that that is an addictive pattern. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, facing it, now there's often other healing. I personally love the 12-step programs. They make sense to me. that, you know, the root of the pain, the emotional pain that we're running away from, the root of the pain is emotional, and that the compulsive behavior in some way is going to be a physical addiction. And then the cure is spiritual. And to me, that means getting back into right relationship with myself, mm-hmm. with the universe, you know, with all that is in some way. And that makes sense to me. So my higher self has a sense of humor. So while I was discovering that I was a sex and love addict, I was actually studying Tantra. And if you've ever studied American Tantra, it's very sexy. It's very mm-hmm. sexy. It's very like up in each other's faces, breathing each other's pheromones, rocking each other's pelvises against each other. You know, it's very sexy stuff. And I actually had to breathe and ground and keep my own energy centered, rather than to just smear it all over another person, or to, you know, just merge, as Tantra often teaches us to do, American Tantra. And it ended up being great training as a healer, because what it means mm-hmm. is that I have the capacity, even if someone else is in very highly aroused states, to keep the container clear for them and not have it be about me, and not have it mm-hmm. be about me or against me, that it's, you know, that it's a container being held for their healing, not a container to get me off. So so it's this awareness, a really a commitment to come back to center, to stay in center, to not want the crash, to understand the cost of the crash. And then for me personally, I don't let myself get high. Like, I don't get into all these, like, oh, wow. Like, when I notice myself getting, you know, kind of very delusional, like, oh, my God, we have everything in common. We like music. We like sunsets. We like chocolate ice cream. We just have everything in common, which is the phase that we often do when we meet someone new, where we're, like, grasping for every little thing we possibly have in common. We were both in Paris at some time in our lives. You know, we both graduated from college. We have everything in common. And so when I start to notice myself doing that, I say, oh, look, Francesca, you're doing that. And it's not real. And until you would rather sleep through the night than have sex with them all night, until you feel grounded around them rather than high around them, you don't really love them. You don't really love them until you know how bad it gets and how good it is, and you love both sides. Let me just tell you, Francesca, if you're allowing yourself to feel any of this, it's a high. It's not real.
Yeah, someone was just telling me that when they meet someone new, they do a little ritual where they say, here's something I'm afraid for you to know about me. And they go back and forth telling each other all the things that they're afraid for the other person to find out, and kind of get it out of the way right in the beginning, instead of this pie in the sky, oh, we're so perfect together. Because until you really know the bad things about a person and whether you can live with that, it's never going to work long term.
And it's going to take time, because even if we did that together and felt really bonded, like, oh, aren't we brave? We have so much in common. We revealed our imperfections to each other. We're both so brave. Actually, it's going to take anywhere from 3 to 9 months, sometimes longer if you only see each other, you know, once a month or once every few weeks, because then the dopamine resets. Dopamine is anticipation and reward. It's what gets us addicted to shopping, gambling, video games, et cetera, et cetera. And so that sense of, like, just seeing someone every few weeks, the dopamine can keep being reset, so the high can last a lot longer. If you actually mm-hmm. move in with someone or start seeing them every day, then the high is going to drop fairly quickly. And then but whenever the drop is when you finally start to see, who are we without the internal high? Now that
so
we're
how
sober.
Does a recovering, yeah, how does a sober or recovering sex and love addict have sexual vibrancy? How do you know how to do that in a healthy way that's not tapping into your addiction?
I love that question too. I decided I didn't want to be out of control. I felt very powerless about my sexuality at one point because I didn't know how to create my own arousal. And now this is very typical for humanity. So in general, in humanity, the way we look at arousal is, I have no arousal. I have no arousal in my body until I watch pornography, until I see a sexy person, until you kiss me, until I smell your pheromones, until we have a great conversation. I don't have any arousal. Well, if all my arousal exists outside of me, then of course you're going to be my drug. Of course I need you as my fix because I don't have it in me. But I decided to research the autonomic nervous system and research the studies that show that we can take charge of so much of our heart rate, our breath rate, our hypertension, our so many things. Scientists and studies have shown that the mind is so much more powerful at creating health, at creating, sometimes transforming diseases or creating diseases. There's studies like the inner game of tennis that show that the mind can't tell the difference between something powerfully imagined and something that actually happens. For a while, I kept dating men that I found less and less physically attractive because I was training myself to create my own arousal. And I studied Tantra and Taoism and also these psychological, neurobiological systems in order to train myself that my arousal exists in me, that I can create it and make myself very aroused, or I can dampen it and take down my arousal so that I don't have to just be carried away because someone's so hot or they're so sexy and I can't keep my hands off them, even if I think they're bad for them, which is a thing that many of us do, or I've done, where I've gone after men that were actually very damaging to me because I just felt so turned on by them. I couldn't stop myself. And then the converse is true, that somebody who's a really nice guy, a really good guy, well, he doesn't turn me on, so I'm not going to date him. I'm going to date this jerk who treats me terribly because he's my turn on, but I'm going to run away from the guy who's going to treat me beautifully? No. So I actually trained myself to choose my own arousal. And it took practice. One of my partners, it took 9 months. It actually took 9 months of doing particular breathing practices and visualization practices. But after 9 months, I had rewired myself so that after that 9 months, he was always attractive to me. Like I was able to run the neurological pathways that made it real. Now, did it take work? It did. But it gave me so much hope for long-term relationships too, because people, quote unquote, lose the spark. Of course they're going to lose the spark. That's going to pretty much happen with everybody that you live with. But by doing this study for myself, I'm like, oh, but I could now sustain arousal with my partner in the long run because I'm in charge of it, not a chemical dump that happens only when you meet someone new. And so this is like the exciting part of this is the ownership of it, the agency of it, that I can create it where I want it to be.
Right. Beautiful. So you're just a wealth of information, Francesca. I could talk to you all day, but I'm aware of the time, and I want to move on and ask you about something that you termed in your writing, inner polyamory. Can you tell us what you mean by inner polyamory, and how does it help create happy, delicious, delightful relationships?
Oh, Sumati, you delicious woman, you. I love inner polyamory. So one of the things that I heard when I would ask people, you know, why do you want to be polyamorous? And, you know, if you ask 20 people, you might hear 20 different reasons. But after a while, you'll start to hear some main reasons. And one possible reason, not the only one, but one possible reason is I discover myself. Through dating people, every person is a country. Every person is a world. When I date someone new, I discover more about myself in relating to them. You'll sometimes hear, I'm a multifaceted person. You know, there's many different parts of me. So when I just date one person, they can't meet all those parts. You know, if I like dancing and you like dancing, great. But then let's say I like to also play chess, but you don't like to play chess. Well, now I need another lover. You know, I need another lover who likes to play chess. And let's say I'm also kinky, but you're not kinky. Well, now I need another lover who's kinky is another way of looking at that. Well, one of the things that I started to look at in this was who is inside of me? when, you know, when I might say I discover myself through other people, when I say I want more than one person so that I can actually meet or be met in different parts of myself, what am I actually saying? So as I started to dig into this, I started to discover more and more about who was living inside me. That, you know, there's this adorable little girl, that there's this rebellious teen, like, who the fuck are you? Why the fuck should I listen to you? And there is mm-hmm. this animal that just kind of sniffs through the world, like sniffing at food and people. There's the wise woman that really is connected to spirit and has such profound wisdom. There's, you know, there's the nurturer. There's the savior. There's the killer. You know, there's the vampire. There's all these different parts of me. And as I discover them, I'm like, oh, my God, no wonder I've been confusing to myself and others. Because I didn't know. I hadn't actually mapped who was on the inside. Well, when I started to be able to really refine this mapping of who I was on the inside, I was able to help other people do that as well. So instead of just being a blur of, I know that I have a lot of parts and I feel like you don't fulfill all of them, baby, to be able to say, oh, I've got this part, this part, this part, not just even my, you know, I like skiing versus I love chess versus I love dancing, but actually looking at the parts. You know, this is my masculine, this is my feminine, this is my monster, this is my animal, this is my little one, this is my, you know, and actually be saying, you know, my little one and my nurturer adore you, but I don't think that we actually meet in the primal. And then maybe if I can language it like that, you can also say, well, Francesca, I'm not even sure I met my primal yet. Would you help me meet my primal? And so now we're actually putting it's kind of like opening the hood of the car and actually discovering, you know, that what's how the engine runs, instead of just going, there's an engine under that hood there and it does something. It's mm-hmm. actually being able to work with it. And when I started to do this and help my partners to do this, what started to happen with some partners is we would say that we were having a polyamorous relationship between the two of us. So one of my partners, his little boy loved my little girl, and he had like an inner kind of gargoyle monster and that matched my inner gargoyle monster. And then he had a kind of a Buddhist shaman that matched my priestess. And he had a warrior that, and I had kind of an Amazon. And what we ended up discovering over time is that we needed to create dates for these different inner aspects, or we would have jealousy mm-hmm. towards ourselves, you know, like, you know, my inner teen is feeling really angry that the little girl is getting so much attention. and one of the things that he said to me, he said, Francesca, you know, dating you or having sex with you is like having 100 lovers. Because you are so, each inner aspect inside you makes love differently. Because if we really start to distinguish who's inside, each one wants to dress differently. Each one of them makes love differently. Each one of them has different food interests. And we start to be able to, you know, expand our capacity, not with everyone, but we might discover that with some people, we may have the opportunity to practice inner polyamory together. And you know, and that's delicious in its own right. And for some of us, that fulfills a lot of the desire to go broad, you know, like saying, oh, I need at least 13 lovers to feel fulfilled. Well, if I've got 3 lovers that I'm practicing inner polyamory with, that might feel, you know, more than fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. And so do you teach that? Do you have workshops about that, or do you teach your clients that?
I do. I work a lot with clients who, when they've lost the spark, or they have very different sexual styles, I work with mm-hmm. them around inner polyamory to find different parts of them, different inner aspects. For instance, there was a couple where she was the tired mama at the end of the day, and he was the playful boy. So she'd come into the bedroom, like, exhausted, and he'd, like, throw a pillow at her. You know, this was not a good sex life. But I worked with them to discover, you know, her king and her queen. And those two inner aspects adored each other and really wanted to have sex with each other. I've often been able to bridge what our
on the one hand, start to look like sexual differences. By one person's kinky, the other person isn't. One person seems to have a higher sex drive, the other one doesn't. One person feels like they're more open, the other one feels more closed. By, you know, working with some of this inner polyamory concept. And then, yeah, I teach it, especially in my 8-month class.
Fascinating. And do you think that the tired working woman kind of needed to have a space held for her before she could go to her inner queen? That she needed to be seen and have compassion and understanding for that tired person as well before she could open up all these other aspects of herself?
You know, it's certainly, I would feel that both people need empathy, you know, that he deserves empathy for his joy and his innocence and his wonder that wants to come into the relationship that isn't being met. And then she would deserve empathy for being tired at the end of the day. Of course, they would both deserve empathy. But sometimes all the empathy in the world isn't going to get them to get their spark back.
Right. Got it. Interesting. So I just have one more quick question before we run out of time. Can you tie in the kink BDSM stuff that you do? How does that relate to non-monogamy?
Now, there are so many forms of non-monogamy. There's no one true right and only way to do any of this. And in the community of kink, now, could you be monogamous and kinky? You can. Could you practice inner polyamory and be into BDSM? You can. And it is often a delicious place to explore. I'm also believe in being monogamish, to explore anywhere from monogamish to non-monogamy in the kink community. And what that means is if you're a monogamish, you might go to a party and say, we're going to maybe scene with some other people, you know, spanking and floggings and, you know, constraint or, you know, role play or whatever, but we're not maybe going to have penetrative sex. And we're going to have this juicy energy and we're going to have this, you know, delicious yum, but we're going to take it home and have, you know, the cherry on top with each other. Or, you know, you could say we're going to play with other people, including, you know, sexual genital touch or penetrative sex at the party, but not outside the party. Or you could say that the party is an opportunity to find other lovers or other partners that we may or may not share. So the community of kink and BDSM, I would say, is very, very open and very, very accepting of non-monogamy, although there are monogamous couples within it. It is certainly a place to explore, if one wanted to, everything from being monogamish to swinging to polyamory to open relationship or, you know, whatever flavor feels good to you.
Got it. Or there are definitely couples where one person is into the kink scene and the other isn't, so they can pursue their kink outside the relationship because their primary partner isn't into it. So some couples agree to do it that way as well.
Exactly, exactly. Although I would often say if you're interested in seeing if you can bridge that, I would love to talk to you because it's one of my happy places. To help people who think, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. That's just so not who I am. To discover ways to bridge that instead of, and it's not that they couldn't also use that as a form of polyamory or having a different lover, but if you wanted to also see if there's a way to bridge that, I'm very excited by that. So I've definitely
right. There's
had,
so many
yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I had a couple where she realized she was submissive 11 years into the marriage, and he said, well, I'm not kinky, and I don't want to be a dominant. And I was able to work with him to kind of distinguish what did he say he didn't want to be? Okay, you don't need to be that. And what if being a dominant wasn't that? So I get that there's this thing you don't want to be, and I'm supporting you in that. And what if being a dominant was different than that? Or if somebody says, well, I'm not submissive and I don't want to be submissive. Okay, what is it that you think submissive is that you don't want to be? And let's make sure you don't do that. And
beautiful.
What if it could be different than that?
Right, because we can define it however we want.
That's the beauty of the world.
Okay, well, yes. So we're almost out of time, and I want to be sure that you have enough time to tell us how we can reach, tell our listeners how they can find you. And I believe you have an offer for our listeners as well. So you've got about 3 minutes.
You can reach me, Francesca Gentile, G-E-N-T-I-L-L-E. You can Google Francesca Gentile, and you'll find lots of me. It's francescagentile.com. You can reach me that way. And I am offering, for our listeners, I'm offering a free session. And if you email me and at relationshipdiva@gmail.com, that's relationshipdiva@gmail.com, you can get that free one-hour session with me, and I would love to talk with you about, you know, what's important to you and what's happening in your life and how we can work with that, including two other tools. One is called the Tools of the Mind and the Traps of the Mind, two other documents, and a document called You Can Fall in Love with Anyone.
And they can get that by emailing you?
They can.
Fabulous. Well, that didn't take 3 minutes, so let's take 1 minute to talk about you co-authored a book called The Marriage of Sex and Spirit. Is that still being published, or are people
it
able to get copies of that?
Published. It is being published.
It's
you
not...
can often get it at, you know, at my house, or you can get it on Amazon. And it's a beautiful book. It has over 18 chapters. And Geraldine Gendreau was the main editor in it, and I was the co-editor, and I also have a chapter in it called With My Body, I Thee Worship.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, Geraldine's a fabulous writer. I didn't realize you worked with her. Wonderful. Okay, well, we're about out of time. I just want to thank you so much for all of the wisdom that you showered on us today, Francesca. And I wish you the best of luck in all of your endeavors.
Thank you so much, Sumati. I love being on here, and you are such a wise and beautiful spirit. And it's an honor to be on your show.
Thank you so much. Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.